Well, look, Andrew, I couldn't be more excited to get to have this conversation with you. We had a brief chat earlier this week, and I did suggest that an anthropologist and an economist having a conversation together was the beginning of a joke neither of us would find funny. But I'm really excited we get to talk about this book, which I would just like, look, I have dog-eared it appropriately and poster tagged it. Before we begin, though, I also want to acknowledge where we are today on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri. I want to pay my respects to elders past and present. I want to acknowledge we're on land that was always sacred and never ceded. I want to pay my respects to other First Nations people in the room. I want to remind everyone to silence their cell phones. And I want to think about the fact that in the world we find ourselves in, it's probably not just enough to acknowledge anymore. I think we have to think about what our open commitments are. For me, that means thinking about what I commit to every time I acknowledge something. And as you and I have discussed in other moments, for me, coming back to Australia after being gone for a very long time means that I often reflect on my time in the US where all the names I didn't hear. And I think about what it means that over a 30-year period, I didn't hear someone talk about the Lenni Lenape and the Mashantucket Pequot and the Algonquin and the Shoshone Bailac and the Alawan, and how remarkable it is that we get to be here and say the names of the country that we're on and think about what that means. And for me, that's an extraordinary way to start a conversation.
Mm.
So we're really happy to get to have you here at the ANU. I'm incredibly excited for a book entitled The Shortest History of Economics. I always feel like that's a bit of a cheeky title. And I realized we could do an interview just based on every case study in the book. So for those of you who don't have the book, about every 30 pages, there's a gray page, like a pop-out page, where there are histories of things like the economics of religion, which was excellent, the importance of surnames in social mobility, which I also particularly found fascinating, an entire piece about the Medici as philanthropists you didn't know you didn't need, tulip mania, which we're going to come back to, a piece on the gender gap, and they were, oh, and shipping containers. I should have mentioned I have a small fetish of the shipping container. One of the many things I like, as you know, because Andrew's interviewed me, so the fact that I now get to interview him feels like a delightful turnabout. And so we could have just talked about those, and I'm tempted to, but what I really wanted to do instead, I think, was focus on just three things. One, how you're thinking about economics and why. Two, why you decided to use economics to talk about history, because I think that's actually what this book is. I don't think the book is actually about a history of economics. I think it's about a history of the world using economics as a lens. And then I thought, because we're in the week of International Women's Day, we'd have a little bit of a conversation about the economists that matter. And in this instance, spoiler alert, the economists you probably don't know. You ready for that?
Absolutely.
Excellent. So, you defined economics in two places in this book that I thought were interesting. One was the very beginning, which is a good place to do that, where you said economics can be defined as a social science. The Dean of Social Science and I pause here and go, interesting. That studies how people maximize their well-being in the face of scarcity. And then you go on to talk about the behavior of people as individuals and how we work together in different kinds of collective forms, which is certainly, you know, I think a coherent way of doing it. And then later on in the book, you come back to that kind of thread to define it again, where you instead say that actually maybe what economics is a form of inquiry, where you say maybe it's about using maths as a shorthand language, maybe it's about translating maths into English, using the English to illustrate the examples, and then burning the mathematics. If you're a mathematician in the room, I'm sorry. He obviously doesn't mean it quite like that. I guess I'm interested, my question, I wonder what the question is there. Why those two ways of thinking about economics, and what do you gain by that? So the shortest history of economics, if you have a room full of people, how are you defining that?
So there's a number of ideas in economics which are really fundamental to thinking about a whole lot of areas of life. The notion of scarcity and trade-offs, the idea that when you think about doing one more thing, typically that involves doing less of something else. When a person tells you they should teach it in schools, then the right question for an economist to ask is, okay, but what should they not teach in schools so they can teach your thing? The notion of thinking at the margin, thinking about what happens if we have one more of something rather than the average impact, is fundamental to economics. And the principle of specialisation, which comes through in the labour market. So most of us in the room specialise in some particular set of skills and earn a higher wage as a result of specialising. Yet so too nations that specialize can increase their prosperity by focusing on what they're best at. A lack of specialization turns you into a sort of a human Swiss Army knife with a dodgy blade, a pair of scissors that don't cut very much, and a screwdriver you'd only use if you were desperate.
And a likelihood that you'll get detained at an airport.
Exactly, exactly. And so specialization is one of the other big ideas. And what I wanted to do, Genevieve, with Shortest History of Economics was not just to tell the story of the world through the lens of economics, why the outcome of World War II was preordained by the material resources at the outset of the war, why sport can be understood through the lens of economics or the career cycles of artists, but also to sketch out how these principles that we teach in first-year economics can be incredibly powerful in people's lives. We undersell economics sometimes. People think of it as just being about the gold price or exchange rates or the stock market. But it's so much more than that. It can help you make decisions throughout your life and make them more wisely. In some sense, the only framework I have for making decisions is cost-benefit analysis, taking into account expected value and discounting in order to decide pretty much any question that you throw at me. And that economic framework of thinking has become increasingly powerful. And the shortest history of economics is also about how some bits of it emerged very early, like markets, and some of it emerged very late, like the supply and demand diagram.
And so, I mean, that's an answer that says economics is a set of practices. You've just declared that you can solve any problem using economics as the paradigm. I'm tempted to suggest the ones that become more difficult, but I think that would be mean-spirited. And of course, as an anthropologist, I'm like, oh my God, none of that's true. At all.
So this is really interesting, right? Because your discipline thinks so much about the particular and about how societies are unique. And mine is much more about trying to generalize, recognizing that like a map, won't be an exact replication of the territory, so too a model won't be an exact replication of reality.
Yeah, so then we're arguing about, is it a painting of London or the subway map?
Very nicely put, yes.
Indeed. Both representations of a similar thing and two very different skews on it. Yeah, look, I think the thing I thought was interesting in those definitions of economics is partly it's a laddering up of a collection of ideas that start to suggest in order to have an economic frame or an economic discipline, you need to be able to see the world in certain sorts of ways. You have to be able to see a market, you have to be able to see the forces inside that market or across that market. You have to think about ways of representing mathematically, then burn the maths, how those forces work. And early in the book you say that thinking like an economist is a skill everyone should have. What is it that that skill actually looks like?
So I think like an economist is to, well, let's take an example. Let's think about crime. Before Gary Becker came along, many people thought about crime as being something that was done by bad people.
And to be clear here, Gary Becker is not a criminal, but an economist.
Exactly. It's as best we know. Although, in the process of thinking about the economics of crime,
he committed
an offence, which is that he was running late for a meeting one day at the University of Chicago, and he thought to himself, I can either park legally and be late, or I can park illegally. Now, if I park illegally, there is some chance of getting a fine, and I should take the value of the fine and multiply it by the probability that I will get that fine, and then compare that to the value that I place on arriving at my meeting on time. And from that he thought, well, maybe this is the right way of modelling a whole lot of other crimes in society. Not thinking of crime as being something that is committed by people who are different from us, but thinking about criminals as people like the rest of us who are facing incentives. From that comes thinking about how increasing policing might change the probability of detection, or increasing sentence length might change the expected cost. Many of those who work on the economics of crime say, well, if you've got someone with a very high discount rate, perhaps raising the sentence from 10 years to 20 years won't make much difference, because if they're contemplating walking into a service station with a sawn-off shotgun, they're probably almost by definition not placing very much value in what's going to happen in a decade's time. So that framework of incentives, thinking about crime through the as a market with supply and demand, and recognizing that most changes in society are driven by policy and technology rather than by shifts in social norms. Well, that gives you a bit of a snapshot as to what it is to think like an economist.
And for the first time has explained to me a sign that used to be by the side of the road in the great state of Pennsylvania that discouraged you from speeding. And it told you that if you were 1 to 10 miles above the speed limit, this would be your fine. If you were 10 to 15 miles above the speed limit, this would be your fine. And if you were 15 to 20 miles above the speed limit, this would be your fine, and over that you'd get arrested. And it was definitely a calculation that was indeed exactly to your point, like what's your willingness to pay?
Absolutely. And, I think this is a useful insight, which is...
not usually manifested in public policy regarding traffic fines, however, quite so visibly.
Well, it does come up in public transport fines. So one of the things you'll notice around the world is that if you have very good gates to go in and out of a public transport system, then the probability of skipping through those gates is very low. So think about the London subway system. The fine for travelling without a ticket on the London subway system, last time I checked, was £10. By contrast, in places like Sydney, where a lot of the train stations don't have gates, it's actually quite easy to travel without a ticket. And there the fine sits over $100. So in both cases, they're thinking about the trade-off between detection probability and the size of the penalty. Multiply those together, that's the expectation of what will happen when you travel without a ticket.
Yeah, and I can think of it being used in other ways, right? So Singapore, famously, when they started to introduce their tagging system on cars and were driving, bad pun intended, people to use public transport, they had a real-time economic leaderboard as you came into the city that said, if you go through the city now, your congestion charge is this. If you wait an hour, it's this. By the way, there's a train at the next train stop and it'll be there in 10 minutes. And it was definitely trying to get people to not exactly think like an economist, but be able to think about the trade-offs between time, money, and activity. But in that instance, it's about incentivizing a behavior rather than disincentivizing one.
That's right. And incentives work in all kinds of other interesting ways. So the NBA decides they want to make the game more interesting, and so they move to the three-point rule, saying that if you take a shot from further away, then you'll get rewarded more highly from that. That immediately has the effect of changing players' behaviour as the incentives shift. Tournaments that have a very big prize for first and a smaller prize for second, if it's a running race, runners will run faster. If it's a golfing tournament, golfers will tend to finish in fewer shots. So those sports people are responding to incentives. Now, in 2004, Australia put in place a baby bonus. All babies born after the 1st of July 2004 got $3,000. Those born on the 30th of June 2004 didn't get the bonus. It was expected beforehand that there wouldn't be any shift, but as it turned out, 1,000 births were shifted from June into July so people could get that bonus. Regular births stayed the same, but you saw huge changes in induction procedures and caesarean sections, responding to the financial incentive the government had put in place.
I'm mildly frightened to ask you what incentive structures the current government might want to put in place.
Well, if we are, one of the lessons from the baby bonus is that we shouldn't have this sharp discontinuity. It would have been very straightforward to put in place the policy without that. And indeed, if you think that taxes affecting the timing of births is bad, in the United States, changes in inheritance taxes have changed the timing of deaths. You can see deaths being moved in order to minimise the inheritance tax bill as the United States changes its inheritance tax.
I'm inclined to say when you think like an economist, that's not it. I'm going to move you off definitions of economics because I feel we've veered into complicated territory. And I wanted instead to kind of pull you back to what is the arc of this book, which for me, yes, it's about a history of the development of the ideas of economics, right? How do you go from the first markets and the first corporations to thinking about more sophisticated levers for changing everything from monetary policy to the way people actually make sense of the flows of capital. I'm also interested throughout this book the way you use economics as a way of making sense of history. Because I think this book operates at that level too, right? This is very much, a history of the world as told both by an economist using economics as the kind of the vantage point, right? So you kind of flash through a series of historical moments, and it's always about how the money is moving and what the kind of consequences are of that, and even the creation of money, ideas about, you know, creating ledgers. And for me, one of the things that's always really interesting about history, and one of the ways I use it in my own practice, is I tend to think it doesn't give us answers for the present, but it gives us much better questions to ask about the world we find ourselves in, right? Is that there are things that have happened in the past that won't happen again, but the ways they unfolded are deeply instructive. And you and I have talked in other circumstances about, you know, where I have worked of late in Silicon Valley, about, you know, where I sit kind of producing new forms of technology. Certainly AI, artificial intelligence, has been a place I've spent a lot of time thinking of late. And I'm wondering if you'll indulge me. So in the book, you talk a little bit about the Dutch East India Company, the British East India Company, and tulip mania. And I'm wondering if you'll talk about all three of those things, and talk about them in such a way, because I know you were thinking it when you were writing it, that all of those things are also stories that would be true today. Because the Dutch East India Company and the British East India Company feel remarkably like proto-versions of large transnational tech companies, and tulip mania feels a lot like cryptocurrency. Discuss.
Wonderful. Wow. So this is what happens when you engage with somebody who thinks, well, the book is interesting, but I now want to discuss with you everything that that you didn't write about.
That's
in the
not
book.
True. You put, I can tell you exactly where it is.
No, but your question is far deeper than anything that's in the book. Now let's just be clear about that with the audience. The Dutch and British East India companies really were the monopoly giants of their age. Corporations which were set up by governments and given licenses to not only trade, but also to run armies and to effectively carry out colonization for colonial powers.
So we should sort of reflect back when this is happening and what the range of the world is, right? So we're talking 15 and 1600s?
Yes, and going through to the 1700s. So the age of sail, in which double-masted ships come to the fore, and a range of shipping technologies speed up the ability of ships to travel around the world. Trade is at a premium, of course, because there's different endowments in different countries, and so there's a desire to get spices back to improve the taste of food, to get sugar and tea coming into Europe. And through that, the notion that if you give a monopoly to a large trading company, they will do the right thing emerges. Of course...
Which should sound vaguely familiar.
Yes, they do the right thing by their shareholders, well, not always by those who are being colonised. And
which
the
is, of course, the other... The other important part of these early companies, as I understand it, is it's also about doing two other things, right? One is, rather than investing in an individual boat or an individual captain or an individual voyage, you're diminishing the risk because you have a corporation that's now holding everything. But that also means that corporation can drive innovation because they now have resources and reach, right? So they become a bit like they then control the shipping lane or the infrastructure in this sense, right? Am I understanding it also correctly?
Absolutely. And so, you know, we take it for granted now that an investor can put money into a company and they stand to lose that money, but not then to be sued for any damage or further losses that come from the company. But that notion of limited liability is a relatively new one and emerges out of some of these initial investments. As you've so perfectly put it there, Genevieve, the notion of shipping is one which has great potential reward and great potential risk. If the ship comes back, it can come back with multiples of the value of what you sent it overseas with. But many voyages were scuttled or were unable to return with the cargo that they'd hoped. And so an investor who puts all their money into a single ship stands to lose their entire fortune. But if you can pool risk by putting money into multiple voyages, then you're able to get the expected value in returning. And so from that comes investment in ships, and the country that then has those institutions, which is characteristically Britain, has a set of financial institutions that can help spur the Industrial Revolution. If the question is, why did the Industrial Revolution first take place in a little island off the coast of mainland Europe, well, the answer is in part through the financial institutions that encourage risk-taking. But you've also pointed so rightly to the role of monopolies. And when you come to the 20th century and economists are sketching out the way in which perfect markets work, it's people like Joan Robinson who point to the Dutch and British East India Company and say, well, these were not examples of competitive markets with lots of different players. These were examples of a market that's dominated by one or two big players, with the effect that we see so often with monopolies: higher prices and lower quantities, less innovation, less research and development, and sometimes lower wages for the workers as well. So as you get into the 20th century of economics, thinkers like Joan Robinson are saying, well, there's markets, but there's also market failure, and government has a really important role in keeping monopolies in check.
So Dutch East India Company, British East India Company become these forces that control the distribution of things. They create a series of allied businesses around them. I mean, that's how Lloyd's of London comes into existence as a shipping, you know, as an insurance company watching the boats at the dock. There's a whole lot of other pieces of the puzzle. But the piece that I'm always struck by is tulip mania and how that sits in all of this. And I know that sounds like a crazy thing. We're not quite in the tulip season yet, but tell me about tulip mania, Andrew.
So the tulip is a startlingly beautiful flower when it hits Holland. It is unlike anything that that anyone's seen before. And as it comes across from the Ottoman Empire, the Dutch go crazy for it. Tulip bulbs can produce multiple tulip flowers later in the season, and the best of them have a particular disease which streaks the petals and creates an exquisite pattern. The prices of tulips are steadily bid up because the bidding needs to take place before the tulips flower. And at the peak point, you have tulips in a few rare cases turning over for the price of a house. That doesn't last. The price of tulips collapses afterwards. Now, tulip mania is sometimes exaggerated in its effect. Yes, there were stratospherically high prices for a few bulbs at the peak. Yes, they did collapse by orders of magnitude. No, it didn't bring down the Dutch financial system. The tulip market was working much in isolation with the rest of the Dutch financial system, and other players within the system who chose not to bid in on tulips weren't hurt by the collapse of the system. But it is instructive, and it has acted as one of the best metaphors for other crashes, including, as you've said, Genevieve, cryptocurrencies.
And so what do you think it is about that story that's been, I don't know, that continues to be one that gets evoked? I'm always sort of interested in what are the stories we can't let go of, right? And I think part of it, you're right, is that they were beautiful. I wonder if part of it's also that there's something about the spectacle of a city that had a reputation of being remarkably financially literate suddenly being beset with quite demented, for want of a better word, conversations about flowers. And so very serious bankers were worrying about whether the petals and the stamen were going to kind of open at the right level. Does that story get told as a cautionary tale only in the 20th century, or did it operate between the 1600s and now, do you think?
I think it's been a perpetual one. It's hard to see exactly, but there's a lovely Journal of Economic Literature paper which talks about the history of tulip mania and finds lots of instances in which this story has been told and retold. It acts a bit as a bit of a morality tale in some contexts, but it's also important to think about how markets work. What is the true value of a tulip? Well, it's the price that the market is willing to pay. And in an environment in which everyone is changing their expectations of others' willingness to pay, you can see the price bid up and up and up. Maybe the same is true of NFTs as well. Mm-hmm. An asset which doesn't have inherent usefulness, but whose value is largely marked by what others in the NFT market are willing to pay. Shredded Banksy.
A non-fungible token, for those of you not, you know.
Thank you.
Not a problem. And there's a really long technical definition of what that is, but just imagine it's a thing that doesn't exist that gets traded around a lot. Whereas at least tulips were bulbs.
Precisely.
So in the history that you tell there, obviously me, Dutch East India Company, British East India Company, tulips, is there one of those historical moments that you wanted to keep coming back to that you enjoyed writing about?
Oh, the Industrial Revolution is just so endlessly fascinating. So you've got this, you've got the Agricultural Revolution, which increased the productive power of the economy by allowing people to specialise and urbanise at the same time. But much of the gains of the Agricultural Revolution were taken by an elite class which essentially operated as parasites on the rest of the population. You can call them politicians, if you like, who operated standing armies.
So you said that, not me.
I figured I'd better get in first.
Yeah,
operated the standing armies and kept the populace in check. And so much of the surplus in some of these early societies that transitioned through the Agricultural Revolution is turned into an increase in the population rather than increase in the per capita living standards. And indeed, there's even some evidence that heights may have fallen accompanying the Agricultural Revolution, perhaps because diets weren't as diverse. But the Industrial Revolution is different. So the Industrial Revolution sees per person growth kick off in a magnificent pace. And what's striking is the way in which it's sparked by what one economist, Robert Allen, has called a set of interlocking revolutions. Mm-hmm. You've got a revolution in legal institutions, in financial markets, and then you've got this moment where there is what's been called a wave of gadgets spreading across Europe. The spinning jenny, the steam engine, a whole range of innovations which enable those that productivity to take off. Now, and the steam engine is what economists call a general purpose technology, one that can be put to multiple uses, like electrification and now artificial intelligence, which frankly, Genevieve, I'm scared to talk about in your presence. It has the potential to be used by a whole lot of workers in a whole lot of different ways to turbocharge productivity.
Well, and the steam engine, of course, much like today's technologies, is also gated in multiple variations by patent wars that we would recognize.
Yes.
So think Newcomen versus Watt. Think about who gets to control its various instantiations, how it gets riffed on. And for me, that process from a stationary steam engine to a mobile one to the invention of railway is this really interesting idea about a kind of a technology that spans, but it also takes 150 years.
Precisely.
To get that done.
One of the lovely moments that I really enjoyed writing in Shortest History of Economics was the coincidence between Watt filing the patent for the steam engine and the next day Adam Smith publishing The Wealth of Nations. So that intellectual history of the discipline and the world history of one of the key innovations that sparked one of the key revolutions coinciding at that moment is beautiful. And Smith is a seriously quirky person. Somebody who apparently once left his house animatedly thinking about economics and didn't realise he was still in his dressing gown until he reached the next town, some 19 kilometres away, who apparently fell into a tanning pit while discussing economics with a friend. Now, that's serious dedication.
Yeah. And James Watt, who was so neurotic, he gave nothing away and kept everything, including the metal filings. And so when his lab was parcelled up and sent to the Science Museum in London, they didn't know how to sort out, no Marie Kondoing his lab. And so everything, including the metal filings, got packaged up and sent, and they rebuilt his lab in the London Science Museum with everything in it because they were like, maybe it's important. And you're like, maybe he just didn't clean. Because
That's
he'd
beautiful.
Obviously done an economic trade-off. Look, I want to take you to my last kind of set of questions, and you've already presaged this in a couple of different ways, right? In order to have a history of ideas in economics, you end up having a history of people, right? You know, Adam Smith, absolutely, Hobbes, Rousseau, Keynes, Friedman, a lot of different people, some of whom you would know, some of whom you wouldn't. But in honor of it being the week of International Women's Day, not International Women's Day yet, I wanted to ask you about the women historians in here, but I wanted to start with women economists in here, but I wanted to start with someone who isn't an economist, but is arguably the best story I didn't know that I learned from reading this book. Will you tell us about Lizzie Maggie?
Ah, Lizzie Maggie was the inventor of Monopoly. She called it originally the landlord's game, and it was intended as a critique of capitalism. She admired the ideas of Henry George and his notions of a propertied class that were taking advantage of the workers. And so she designed a game which, by playing it, you would come to realise how bad monopolies were. And then Parker Brothers come along and take a version of it and turn it into a game which makes you think that monopolies are good. Frankly, in my household, Monopoly is the game that creates more fights than any other. With three boys, Monopoly invariably ends up in tears. And so I was only too happy to tell the story of Lizzie Maggie because it helped trash my least favourite board game. Ultimately, when there was the story came to light, Parker Brothers paid her only $500 for the game. A great innovator, a great game maker, but somebody whose ideas were not only appropriated, but then turned against the very ideological purpose for which she'd put together Monopoly.
Demonstrating both patriarchy and monopolistic practices. For those of you who have the book, the original diagram for the book is on the board game is on the bottom of page 71. I can firmly encourage you to examine it, because as soon as I got to it, I went, oh my God, it's Monopoly. I do have to tell you that I obviously went to America to go to university, right? And I'd grown up playing Monopoly in Australia, but I'd also grown up playing another board game, Squatter.
Yes.
Which some of you in the room may remember. It's an Australian version created by the Wool Board, which involved sheep. It had many of the same conceits as Monopoly, except every time you passed go, you got wool money rather than utilities. You had rams. And it was all about not moving to hotels, but moving to better land. It was also a game designed to teach Australian children not how to be capitalists, but how to be good collectivists, because it's all about your relationship to the government, not your relationship to the bank, and all about your relationship to the land. And I took a copy of that game with me to America. And it turns out Americans couldn't play it.
Wow.
They kept trying to play it like Monopoly, and they would lose every time. And there are some deeply traumatized colleagues and friends that I have who will never play that game with me again because they throw the little sheep around.
We played Squatter a lot growing up. It never created as many fights as Monopoly, although I wouldn't defend it ideologically.
I'm not sure I can defend either of them, although reading the Squatter hand guide now is quite delightful. So Maggie, or Lizzie, yeah. Joan, you've mentioned. Eleanor Ostrom?
So Eleanor Ostrom is a political scientist who wins the Economics Nobel Prize, because poor political scientists, they don't have a Nobel Prize of their own, and we were only too happy to give to make her the first woman that won the Economics Nobel Prize.
Anthropologists don't have one either. You're going to let us in on the action?
Well, you know, we've gone to psychologists in Danny Kahneman. We've gone to political scientists. It may be something of a stretch, but I'm sure, you know, the two of us can work on the relationship between our respective disciplines.
There we go.
But Eleanor Ostrom looks at the question of the tragedy of the commons. Tragedy of the commons is epitomised in a metaphor of a group of farmers who surround a common pasture. It is in their collective interest to ensure that the pasture is maintained and not overgrazed, but it's in each of their individual interests, knowing that the other farmers will overgraze it, to put too many cattle onto the pasture. And in the tragedy story, the pasture ends up just a dirt paddock because it's overgrazed by everyone. Eleanor Ostrom understood that there could be a tragedy of the commons, but she explored a whole range of traditional societies in which societies had found ways of enforcing a system of rules that prevented the tragedy of the commons from occurring. They'd done this with common areas where rice was planted, common areas where common ponds where fish were farmed. And it turned out that this worked best, she showed through a whole series of studies, when not outsiders imposed rules, but the locals figured out what worked best. These local solutions would frequently solve the tragedy of the commons. And what was beautiful about Eleanor Ostrom's work is that it understood that there could be an economic problem, a market failure, but also recognised the many creative ways in which local people sought to solve it.
And Sadie Alexander?
Sadie Alexander was the first African-American woman to receive a PhD in economics. She's somebody who then should have gone on to a stellar economics career. She was instrumental in surveys of living standards in Pennsylvania, but ultimately unable to receive the academic job she should have had. She went back and retrained as a lawyer and worked on a whole range of important civil rights cases. But her story is one of somebody who understood the empirics of economics and understood the way in which poverty affected households in Pennsylvania, particularly those who couldn't afford to buy in bulk. And some of those insights as to why consumption can be harder for the poor, who have to buy at more expensive local stores, can't buy in the same quantities, are still informing our thinking about poverty today. And particularly in my current portfolio of competition, informs how I think about how a lack of competition can exacerbate inequality.
And of course, it is the week of International Women's Day. The university has just published our pay equity data. Frankly, it's nowhere near where it should be. We are not turning up in that conversation the way we should as a university. We're not alone in that, but we need to be better. Lots of places do. Where is the most recent economic thinking moving in this space?
So the best economist in the world working on gender pay gap, according to the Nobel Prize Committee, is Claudia Golden. Fortunately, in the middle of last year, I'd asked Claudia whether she would be willing to write a quote for the book. I'd gotten to know her at Harvard when she was a wonderfully generous professor in sharing her advice for students on the job market, and stayed in touch since graduating in 2004. She gave me a quote for the front of the book 2 months before she won the Nobel Prize, after which I suspect her inbox has exploded and she's become essentially uncontactable. And her work was of the kind that is deeply embedded in empirics, grounded in theory, but so straightforward that the Nobel Prize Committee, in announcing the prize for Claudia Golden, also produced a cartoon that epitomised her work. I don't know of another instance in which a Nobel Prize has been accompanied by a cartoon. And what it shows is one line at the top of a set of men walking along on a steady level, and then another line of a set of women walking along without children, and then the line dips down, and you can see the women with children earning substantially less. And what Claudia Golden's work has highlighted is the so-called motherhood penalty, the significant gap in wages that seems to widen as women have children. It's not only because as they take on those caring duties, which women have traditionally done to a disproportionate extent, that they're working part-time. It's also that often puts them off the track for higher promotions, gives them less experience, and for what Claudia Golden calls greedy jobs, think judges, vice chancellors, politicians, it makes it much harder for women with children to get to attain those so-called greedy jobs. So a lot of her work is about saying, how do we create more jobs in the economy that are not as greedy? And she shows beautifully that in occupations with a high penalty for working part-time, there is also a high gender pay gap. There's a huge amount to be learned out of Claudia Golden's work on closing the gender pay gap. It's at its lowest level ever right now, went down to 12% in the latest data, but 12% is still way too high.
12% is still 12%.
Precisely.
I may not think like an economist, but I can do that piece of basic arithmetic. Look, our time is almost at an end, so I want to prime people to be thinking about questions. I want to give you Collins' injunction. A question starts with a question word. Who, what, how, where, why are all useful ones. You have a structural advantage here as Australians, which is your voice will go up at the end of the sentence anyway. And so it will sound like a question, even if you don't mean it to be one. But I want to end with a really cheeky question here. So you're talking about John Stuart Mill and about people maximising outcomes and about being able to make trade-offs and think them through. Of course, you and I could talk endlessly about why this presupposes the idea of the rational actor and humans are not rational actors. But in your exercise of thinking like an economist, you write as follows. Opportunity cost can also be a helpful way of making decisions. For For example, if you're undecided about an expensive purchase, a handy rule of thumb is to compare what is the next best way you might spend the amount of money. Perhaps the opportunity for buying that stylish outfit is not seeing your favorite band in concert. So my question, Andrew, was, what is the favorite band?
Look, the best concert that I've seen over recent years was Midnight Oil playing Stage 88 with bats flying overhead and just the beautiful camaraderie of Canberra. And I had to think as I was listening to the concert about a night we had in Parliament where Parliament sat until 3 a.m. And normally sitting to 3 a.m. is horrendous. But on this occasion, I was sitting in the chamber next to Peter Garrett. And Peter Garrett, of course, was a politician, but he never for me ceased being a celebrity. So he just started telling stories. And I said, so what was it like being a student at the ANU? And he said, oh, I loved my time at the ANU, but we did make a bit of a mistake. He said, we lived on this house on Ant Hill Street. And one night we were moving out and we decided that we would have a party in the backyard. So we all got around, we bought some wood and we made a bonfire. And he said there came a point at about 10 o'clock when the bonfire started to go down. And one of the people said, you know, there's a paling fence around here. Do you think it would hurt if we just took one paling off the fence just to keep the fire going? And Peter said, you know, at that point, I should have understood how decisions cascade, but I didn't really think it through. And by the morning, as you can imagine, the fire was still smouldering and the fence was completely gone. And I still think about that whenever I see Peter, and indeed whenever I drive past that where that house is on Ant Hill Street.
And frankly, whenever you think about maximising outcomes.
Exactly.
Look, will you join me in thanking Andrew while you're thinking about questions?
Thank you.
Oh.
We need to take questions from these microphones.
Yeah, exactly. So sorry, there is also a podcast going. So if you've got a hand up, you're going to have to come down to the mic, which means you're going to have to squeeze your way past people. Social awkwardness will abound.
Yeah, or you can just use this chance to run out of the room, which is totally fine as well.
Also true.
Hi. Okay. Testing. 1, 2. Great. All right. So the decentralized finance industry started at about zero 10 years ago and is $2.5 trillion today. With that in mind, how do we attract entrepreneurs to start decentralized finance businesses in Australia?
So, you know, I certainly see the potential of you know, I imagine that you're thinking about cryptocurrencies when you say decentralized
cryptocurrencies
finance.
And also blockchain-enabled trading systems.
Yeah, so, you know, the value of currency is as a store of value, a medium of exchange, and a unit of account. To date, Bitcoin has underperformed on each of those. The transactions are relatively slow. The energy cost is very high, about the same energy use as Estonia. And the currency hasn't managed to hold terribly stable. So Bitcoin's potential to displace cash, I think, has underperformed. But the ability of a blockchain to provide a ledger in which there can be a common understanding, that I think is the exciting space. And that's operating out of a whole lot of different companies. It's got potential wherever you might want to maintain a common distributed ledger. So that for me is the more exciting part than Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies themselves.
I'm going to hold you to one question. You can find him afterwards. I know, I'm mean, but you did really well because it was a question.
Thank you very much for the fascinating discussions.
Closer to the mic. Beautiful.
Thank you very much for the fascinating discussions. In relation to fourth and fifth industrial revolution, what do you think is needed to ensure Australia climbs high on the ladder of innovation, replacing Chang's theory? And what do you think about Black Swan theory?
So Black Swan theory, I remember coming back to me once when we were travelling overseas, and one of my sons looked at a pond and said, "Oh, Dad, I didn't know swans could be white." Which is what happens when you're when you're on the side of the side of the world which has more black swans. We are on the verge of, I think, a potentially really exciting productivity surge as a result of artificial intelligence. BCG consultants ran an experiment where half of them were given ChatGPT, the other half weren't. And in a mock consulting task involving a shoe client, those using ChatGPT were 25% faster and 45% higher quality. I don't know any other technology that boosts productivity in that level without any training at the outset. Beautiful little randomized experiment. So I think if we can harness the power of those technologies, that will be enormously good for productivity. But they've got challenges as well. There'll be potential job displacement. There's risks of artificial intelligence exceeding human capacity without us having built the guardrails around them. And there's challenges in terms of where the returns go. If you look 20 years ago, we had a dozen different internet search engines. Now we have one. If AI goes the same way as internet search, and we have a monopoly AI provider that is presumably located overseas, that's got challenges in terms of distributional outcomes as well.
And you probably wouldn't want to forget there much the same way you cautioned around Bitcoin and blockchain. AI and those systems are incredibly energy intensive. We don't talk about it terribly often, but the energy build for a server farm is both in terms of electricity enormous, but also in terms of water. So at the moment, if you're using ChatGPT in your randomized experiments, you are using the water from an aquifer in Ohio. But at some point, that will be our water, and that's a complicated thing to contemplate because we're talking, I think the last data I saw for Microsoft and Google for their annual reports last year, they had to acknowledge a 30% energy increase in both of their sets of annual reports. So 30% year-on-year increase in water use in one and electricity in the other. And the best modeling I've seen says for every 15 to 20 ChatGPT requests, you're talking half a liter of water. So as we think through how we imagine those solutions, there is a bit about how we make choices about where we think it's useful and where we don't and how we optimize. So for me, in Andrew's book, there is a lovely piece about thinking about the Industrial Revolution, but arguing even as the steam engine, which both he and I will wax lyric about, had we said to James Watt or Joseph Newcomen at the time, look, Sunshine, you're going to build a technology that's going to go global, but could you find a way to not have it consume every piece of wood around it and belch out an enormous amount of smog because that is going to degrade our universes? They might have optimized differently.
Yes.
And I think there's a piece here that as we talk about, you know, the fourth industrial revolution, how we ask as citizens, as regulators, that it's not just about productivity in the traditional senses, but it's also about what the sustainability footprint looks like is a really interesting part of that puzzle.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, is why you're so lucky to have Genevieve Bell as your vice chancellor.
Aww. Thank you.
Let's take a question from over here.
Same, you know, I'm going to go backwards and forwards. Same rule applies. Question, word, voice up at the end.
Okay. So my question kind of goes on a previous talk you did last year about productivity and your kind of studies into that. And I was wondering, how does the kind of concept of non-greedy jobs closing the gender pay gap actually affect productivity? Will we see that increase our productivity levels or will it still be stagnant?
So Claudia Golden's example of a greedy and non-greedy job is to compare law and pharmacy. When you go along to the pharmacist, you don't much care whether you get to see Susan or Bill or Joan or Tim. You go along to a pharmacy and you know because the information is held within their IT system that you will get well treated by your pharmacy. It's a different experience with your lawyer. Most people who go to a lawyer want to see a particular person who needs to hold a lot of information in their heads, and people are much more reluctant to go to a team of lawyers. The result of that is that you get almost no gender pay gap in pharmacy and a big gender pay gap in law. Almost no part-time penalty in pharmacy, a big part-time penalty in law. So Claudia Golden says to us, well, how do we reimagine jobs in which job sharing becomes more feasible, in which you can have an IT system that allows a trade-off between a pair of lawyers or a pair of vets or a pair of doctors? And if workers can operate in teams, then you can have flexibility. That flexibility is good for people who are caring for kids, but it's also good for people who are caring for aged parents. It's also, frankly, good for people who have a serious hobby and would like to work 4 days a week. Or people who have a passion for extreme sport and would like to take a bit of time off to do that. It creates more scope for different people to fit into the employment environment. So that, for me, is the most exciting challenge. And I put that alongside the work of Cal Newport on how we ensure that that email doesn't completely swamp us, how we use technology in order to break up jobs and allow deep work. Intensive periods of deep work are amazingly productive, but Cal Newport argues that many office workers essentially have the job description now of email answerer. They're more like multitasking mad packet switchers than they are people doing serious pieces of deep work. So if you rejig the jobs so that they allow deep work and can be shared, you can have more gender equity and more growth at the same time.
I certainly think the most disturbing applications of ChatGPT I have seen was someone who said to me, I'm using it to answer all my email. It answers it so much quicker, and so people respond quicker. I'm like, that does not seem like a good answer.
Now, I think we should take this one question, and then the gentleman behind I will answer you after we finish, because we're meant to be going to Martine's wrap-up. Sorry about that.
Hi, Andrew. I really loved your book, First Year Economics Student, so maybe it won't be sophisticated, but my question revolves around sort of history as somewhat of a circle. So I ask, would you say there's a fundamental risk within economic policymaking of applying the lessons of history almost as a blanket over all issues rather than adapting to the nuances of the current situation?
What a great question. Yes, there certainly has got to be a danger of that. And one of the reasons that should make you think this is that economics as a discipline has shifted how we think about a range of problems over the years. So Joan Robinson comes in and writes The Economics of Imperfect Competition in 1933 in the face of Alfred Marshall, the grand poobah of the Cambridge Economics Department, who is largely positing a model of effective working markets. We've now seen an analogue of that taking place in the pushback against the Chicago School approach on competition, where in the 1980s and 1990s, the Chicago School approach said, well, big is beautiful, economies of scale, we should allow lots of mergers. And now there's a bit of unwinding from that. So we should be cautious, but what gives me optimism about the discipline, which you have so wisely chosen to study, is that it is more embedded than ever before in data. And to be grounded in data gives you a strong connection to the real world. We have better data than ever before. We're doing more randomized trials. The big data analysis of Raj Chetty using all the tax records of America, all the Facebook connections of America to understand mobility and social connections. That, to me, is a really exciting frontier for economics and will allow us to get insights that then, in turn, feed back to theory. Since we're about to throw to Martine, let me just quickly say, Colin, thank you so much for putting on this series. We are so deeply in your debt, and it was a treat to have you recognised with an Australian honour. And Genevieve, thank you for doing all of us the honour. You are incredibly busy, and to have you in the room is just wonderful.
It was my pleasure. And my closing words to wherever my student was that just went, graduate.
Yes.
You've got 3.5 more years.
And now Martine Mariotti, I think, is going to wrap us up.